accession number 31554, Reel 1.
Harry Leach, Reel 1, Side 1. Where and when were you born?
I was born in Cheadle Hume in Cheshire on the 8th of March 1924.
Where did you go to school?
I went to school at a local school from about 6 years of age until 10, and then I went to a boarding school called Hutton Grammar School near Preston, mainly because the headmaster at the pre-war was a colonel in the officers' training battalion in which my father was trained and got his commission.
So was your father full-time in the army?
Oh, no. No, Dad served in the army during the 1914-18 war. He was wounded in an over-the-top attack and believed he shot the German who threw the sticky bomb at him, because later on he found a helmet with a bullet hole in it. And then he came out and rejoined the old Midland Bank. And he was from 1920 till he retired in 1945, manager of the Cotton Exchange branch, Deansgate, Manchester, which was one of the plum jobs pre-war.
So you had quite a, not affluent, but a nice upbringing in a nice home.
I had two wonderful parents, and of course, through the Depression, my dad had a very good job in the bank. So really, as I was very young, the Depression really didn't understand or know about it. I realise afterwards how lucky I have been.
So did you like boarding school?
I hated it. Bullying was very rife, and I was pretty small for my age group, and I was always in a year where the youngsters were a year older than me, and I didn't enjoy it at all.
Yeah. What age were you there? From what age?
I was at Hutton from my 11 till eventually I came home for Christmas in 1942 and said, I'm not going back to that school again. And that was it.
So what did you do then?
I went in as an apprentice engineer in a firm called Murley's Bickerton and Day in Hazel Grove near Stockport. They were mainly diesel engine builders, large diesel engines to drive ships, small ships, tugs and the like. It was an existence I utterly hated. I was probably the worst engineering apprentice they've ever had, until eventually the convener of the Amalgamated Engineering Union got me my release, because it was wartime and I was reserved. And then I'll come on to that later when we go on to when I joined the army.
And so while you were being an apprentice, did you have home guard duties to do as well?
No, I was too young. I was in the Air Training Corps because I very, very much wished to become a pilot. However, at school, in a small accident in the swimming bus, I lost some of the hearing in my right ear. As you can see now, I have two hearing aids. And this made it impossible for me to go in the RAF, which I wanted, and that probably saved my life, because I would have come in for the 1,000 bomber raids, 1943, early 44, and the casualty rate was very high. So eventually I volunteered for the army. And a funny little story, I went into the Dover Street recruiting office in Manchester, and there was the usual fairly old colour sergeant, and I said, I've come to join the army. Oh, he said, you'll go in this, that or the other battalion. I said, no, I said, I want to go in the Royal Corps of Signals. So he said, you'll go where I blank send you. At that, an officer walked past the door. So I turned and I said, excuse me. Hello, he said, what are you doing here? And I was in Air Training Corps uniform. I used to pass him every morning cycling to work. He said, come on in. So he said, have you got a problem? I said, yes. I said, I'm volunteering for the army and I'd like to go in the Royal Corps of Signals, as it was called then. So he presses the bell and the sergeant comes in. Go and find out when there's a vacancy in the signal sergeant. Sergeant said, yes, sir, not very happy. Came back, 1st of October. This was 1st of October, 1942. So he said, well, does that suit you? I said, yes, thanks. So that's how I came to go into the signals, which I wanted.
And so October came along, and where did you go?
I went by train up to Darlington and then changed and down to Richmond, where trucks picked us up and took us to Catterick Camp, which is in Yorkshire, as you know. And I joined 47 Squad in Lakato Lines under two very good drill instructors, Sergeant Jack Wilderspin and a Lance Corporal, Jock Robertson, who was quite a bit older, both were regulars, two very fine men. They eventually managed to make me more or less keep in step.
So did you find the transition there not too difficult as you'd been to boarding school?
No problem. No problem at all. I remember the first night we got into this barrack room and we were taken up to the mess hall for a meal, and then told lights out was 10 o'clock. So we were sort of all a bit, obviously some much more nervous than others. Having been at boarding school, it was a great advantage. So I looked round and I thought, well, I opened my case and took my pyjamas out and put them on. Ah, that was the key. And I should think a good third of the lads in the barrack room also produced pyjamas and put them, waiting for somebody to start.
So you became virtually the leader of the group just by dint of your knowledge?
I wouldn't say a leader. I've always had sufficient confidence, and you were in a squad, we were all very, very new to the army, and the physical side of it came very easy because I'd been working for 6 months after I got out of the engineering for a friend of mine on a local farm just in Cheadlehume and Alderley Edge. And so reveille was an hour later than I was used to, and I was physically fit and strong, whereas a lot of lads were very, very unfit, and they had to get fit quickly. I found the physical side very easy.
And when you went there, what sort of accommodation were you in? Nissen huts or...?
No, in barrack rooms. Reasonably comfortable, obviously pretty crowded, but having been in boarding school, it was nothing to me. And then from it was number one OTB, and it was the primary training for 6 weeks.
And what did that cover?
That covered everything: marching, drill, rifles, machine gun, everything you can imagine to train a recruit to be at least capable of taking further training wherever he was going.
So your ATC experience again probably
yes.
Came in very useful.
Very, very good. Very great help. From the OTB, then the primary training, I went to number one OTB, Operators Training Battalion, in Kemmel Lines, Catterick. And here I started, from memory, the course was about 3 or 4 months, training to be an operator, wireless and line, in which you were taught to use radio, Morse code, and also running the signal office and all signals duties. I fell on the assault course during this and broke my wrist, which set me back. I went to hospital, and it was about 6 weeks later I came back, and I went for an interview to the what was he called? It was an elderly, very charming major. He was the head of the unit. So he looked at me and said, "Now, laddie, I see you were in week 9, I think it was." "Yes. You should go into week 7. I don't think I'll put you there. Rather a rough lot of lads." He said, "You'll go down to the colour sergeant and take a trade test. Make a bosh of it, laddie. Make a bosh of it. And I'll have a word with him, and you'll go into week 6. A very nice group of boys there. So I walked into this barrack room, and there was, in the barrack room, that there is always one of the squad doesn't go out on training. He's what's called barrack room orderly. He keeps the room clean, looks after it. So this little fellow was sitting on the bottom bunk, and he said, "Hello, come to join us." And I said, "Yes." Well, he said, "There's a bunk above me." And he became a lifelong pal. His name was Frank Guy Gibbons, and he lived just outside Southampton. And sadly, Frank died about 10 years ago now. He had Parkinson's, and Marie and I, my late wife, we used to go over and see Frank and his wife. And the whole of that squad went out to Burma, and they were with the Chindits. Frank flew in, I think it was to Piccadilly, by glider, and of course they had the terrible march out. I missed all that.
I think I'm getting this feeling that you've led a bit of a charmed life.
Well, I think so. So when they were posted, I was posted independently to what they call the holding battalion to wait for my posting to come through. And
Did you find the actual training for the Morse easy? Or?
Oh, yes. We'd already been doing it in the Air Training Corps.
Again,
I can still
thing.
I can still pick up Morse code on the radio, and but I can still read it.
Yes.
Yes.
So really, it was a bit of a doddle, all of this going in.
Well, not quite as a doddle, but I'm sure I had it. My boarding school experience made it much easier than many.
Yes. And did you get much chance to go have some free time in the local town and meet the local ladies?
I've never, ever been one for pub crawling. And so, yes, we could go into Richmond, which is a lovely little old town in Yorkshire. But we were only there for about 3 months. And, of course, as you were training, you weren't allowed out all that much. And then from there, eventually, my posting came through, and I went to Hardwick Hall outside Chesterfield. This is, the hall is still there. This was a physical training centre for the paras, and the whole object of the training was to fail you, to stretch you physically harder and harder and harder. Not a great many dropped out. We had a delightful officer in our squad. He was a Canadian padre who said he was 40 plus years of age. Well, he was 40 plus plus, I can tell you. A delightful man, and more of him later. At Hardwick, you trained really physically hard, and the whole object was to throw out those who were not strong enough to do it. We then went by train to Stockport, which is in Cheshire, and by transport to what is now Manchester Airport, which is Ringway. And here we started our para training. And I'm very sad to tell you that all the old buildings on the far side of the airport from the main buildings, which was called Kilkenny Circus, where we did all our dropping training, you know, practicing rolling, dropping, they've all gone. It's a shame.
Did you find, being quite small, that the carrying the packs and the parachutes and all the necessary equipment difficult?
No problem, because you were so physically built up.
Could you get extra rations?
We ate well, there's no doubt about that. However, the first evening at Ringway, I said to the sergeant, we'll be marched back to our billets. I said, may I please drop out? He said, why? I said, well, I want to catch the bus. I said, I live in Cheadlehulme, which was about 8 miles away. Oh, he said, where do you live? I said, Swan Lane. Good. He said, take a message to my wife in Hilltop Avenue. Tell her I'll be home about 9 o'clock. So I had my bicycle then, and I used to go home every night. And I well remember, during your 8 practice jumps for your wings, you do one night jump. And we did this night jump, and within about half an hour of coming out of the balloon basket over Tatton Park, I was sitting by the fireside with Mum and Dad, still in my jumping kit.
So were you nervous when you did your first jump?
No, I loved it.
And it was you went from the barrage balloons and or the
in the training
in the baskets.
Then, in the training then, you did your first 2 jumps from the static balloon. Mm. And then in the middle of the course, you did that night jump. That's 3. And then the other 5 were from aircraft, which was the old, slow, lumbering Armstrong Whitworth Whitley. They were absolute clapped-out old bombers, but they served their purpose. And so you did individual jumps. Then I think you dropped in pairs, and then in a small stick, and then in a full stick, till you were completely...
How many would be in a full stick?
It depended on the aircraft. In the Whitley, it would be, I think, 10, because it was a small aircraft. Later on, in aircraft like the Stirling, which was an ex-RAF bomber, and the Dakota, which was an American plane, there were probably, depending on how much kit you were carrying, 18 to 20.
How long did it take you to exit the plane?
As quick as possible.
So the whole stick would be out within 30 seconds? Or?
Well, the whole idea was to get out as quick as you possibly could so that you were more or less concentrated.
So
that was the idea.
Did you have any hairy moments coming down?
One or two. In training, no. I have no problems. But D-Day, we were in a Stirling. We flew from Fairford in Gloucestershire, and our pilot was a rather niggly flight lieutenant from the New Zealand Air Force. And this fellow started weaving the aircraft as we were coming in to drop on D-Day. We were not being hit. There was flak about, because you could smell it when you got out. Well, to get about 18 heavily loaded men down the aircraft when the floor is swinging from side to side. Anyway, I was number 13, thereby hangs a tale. We were lined up at Fairford, and my great pal Bert Shea, who lived in Macclesfield, not very far from my home, and we always worked together. We were on the airfield at Fairford, and Bert said, "We can't go, Harry." Well, I knew he always had a great problem screwing himself up to do a jump. So I said, "Well, Bert, you'll get shot," which he could have been. It could have been in the face of the enemy. I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "I'm number 13. I said, "Oh, Bert, is that, will you swap?" "Oh," he said, "yes." So we swapped places. I was number 13 in the aircraft. It was my 13th jump. And the number chalked on the nose of the aircraft for the night was 169, which is 13 squared. So nothing could go wrong. So when I landed, I came down in some trees. So I knew then I was off the dropping zone somewhere. And my chute collapsed and I tumbled down onto this little lane. And I have since, about 10 years ago, managed to find the exact spot where I landed. It's on a little lane called Rue de Mariquet, outside Romeville. And there we gathered together and tried to find out where the heck we were.
Right. Okay, well, we'll go on to your landing at D-Day. And so how long did your training take altogether?
As far as the parachute training, it took about 2 weeks at Chesterfield at Hardwick Hall. As quick as they could get you through at Ringway, depending on the weather. Normally about 10, 12 days. And then from there on, you were continually being trained. The training getting more and more realistic into larger and larger exercises. Before D-Day, there were two very big exercises called Biz 1 and Biz 2, in which we, 3rd Parachute Brigade and ours, 5th Parachute Brigade, simulated a mass drop as not would be done on D-Day, but it was good practice. We didn't actually drop because the wind was too high. We actually flew out over the channel with hundreds of Spitfires escorting us in full kit, weapons, everything. And we sort of got nearer and nearer the French coast. We said, "The so-and-so's, it's the real thing," but it wasn't. We turned around and came back.
So what sort of armaments did they train you on? What would you take? Sort of stone submachine guns?
We were Royal Signals, and we were...
You were sort of attached to them, were you?
No, I was in the Royal Signals.
Yes. Oh, I see, yes.
I wasn't what they call a signaller in an infantry battalion. I was an infantryman trained to signals. I was a signalman. My rank was signalman, not private. And we were mainly signals. Contact with the forward battalions or any other units in the brigade, and contact rearwards to division headquarters, and sort of all points in between. My main work with the section, with Bert Shea and our corporal, Lance Corporal Milton, Bob Milton, was running the signal office and the telephone exchange and signals in and out. Thereby hangs another tale. I was on the signals exchange in Normandy, and we were in a sandbagged enclosure in what had been a garage, and there was a flash and a bang from the exchange. I was talking to somebody at Wistrom and never heard from them again, and I had the telephone in one hand at my ear, and the lad said, "I went straight up in the air and over backwards and landed on the other side of the garage, unconscious, with the telephone still in my hand, with a bit of smoking wire. Somewhere the line had been struck by lightning." And I remember our OC, Captain Radmore, said, well, come on, get back on the exchange. And apparently, I don't remember it, but I apparently turned to him and said, not bloody likely. However, I got away with that.
So when you were dropping with parachute, would you have had radio kit on your back?
We had,
19
no.
set or something like
we
that?
We had our own kit, which is the normal kit a soldier bears, and then we had strapped onto our legs a large padded kit bag with all our extra kit in there and whatever wireless or whatever kit we were carrying. This kit bag was joined to your belt by a thick rope with a friction glove on it. So when you came out of the aircraft and your chute opened, you then pulled the safety pins out of the straps on your leg and lowered the bag down about 30 feet of rope with a friction glove, so that when you came down, the bag hit the ground first, and you could see a parachutist coming down, and his bag would hit the ground, and his descent immediately slowed, and then you landed after it, picked it up, and went on.
So with these two training exercises, did you have any interference from enemy?
Oh, no. It was all in England. Mm. And, we were well protected by the RAF. And, of course, the Luftwaffe, they were not non-existent, but there were no great threat then. They were completely dominated because there were thousands of fighter aircraft out and about all the time.
Would you have had a personal protection weapon on you?
In the job I was doing, we were not, obviously not expected to fight, except in emergency, and my normal weapon was a rifle. But thank goodness I never fired it in anger. I had my job to do, and this is what we did. Mm.
So after you'd had these two training exercises, what happened then?
Well, the next thing, we were completely kitted up and ready for D-Day, which we knew was coming, but we didn't know then where. We were then taken by our transport to a secure holding camp. I don't know exactly where this was. We were in a big compound with barbed wire all round and armed guards keeping us in. We were not allowed out at all because we were being briefed for D-Day. And I remember one of our dispatch riders, they were allowed out because they had their job to do. And he sneaked off home to London. And unfortunately, coming back, he had a very bad accident and was sent to hospital. And fortunately for him, he was coming back. And we never saw him again because I gather it was a very serious accident. But if he'd been going to London, he would have been in very serious trouble. But he got away with it, I believe.
So, but when you had free time, was there much inter-division rivalry? Did you do sports against each other, boxing and rugby?
I'm physically not very large, as you can see. So, I was always touch judge for the brigade rugby team, and this gave me some very nice trips out with the team. One particular trip was to Downside, the public school where Brigadier Poet had been as a boy, and that was quite an experience. Apart from that, I had some very good friends.